This conversation on holobiont is with Dr. David Bicard, who is head of the synthetic biology group at Institut Pasteur in Paris and co-founder of Eligo, a really promising biotech company whose aims are to harness the potential of CRISPR to target pathogenic bacteria and to engineer the microbiome. CRISPR is really a field in expansion. It's receiving a lot of press, and I'm not sure it even needs an introduction, but very briefly, the CRISPR-Cas system is an adaptive immune system evolved by archaea and bacteria that works by capturing DNA from viruses and other foreign genetic elements and keeping it as an imprint of past infection. This is then used to prevent reinfection by using the templates as RNA guides that direct Cas nucleases, which are enzymes that cleave DNA, to degrade the foreign sequences. The incredible power of this system is that the RNAs can actually be artificially designed to target any DNA sequence of choice. And this has made them incredibly valuable genetic engineering tools to modify bacteria, mammalian cells, and even human cells. The focus of this episode, though, will be on the use of CRISPR as a magic bullet technology to specifically target antibiotic resistant or pathogenic bacteria, which really would be a game changer as opposed to broad spectrum antibiotic approaches currently used that are detrimental both to the microbiome by non-specifically wiping out the commensal bacteria, but also favoring the spread of antibiotic resistance. To start by introducing yourself, telling us a bit about your academic background and your current position.
So my name is David Bicard. I'm the head of the synthetic biology group at the Pasteur Institute. And I did my studies in France, my PhD already at the Pasteur Institute and Université Paris Diderot. I then did a postdoctoral fellowship at the Rockefeller University, where I stayed for 3 years in the laboratory of Luciano Marafini. And that's where I started to work on CRISPR-Cas systems. And after that, I came back to France and to the Pasteur Institute to start my own group.
Okay, great. And so some of your landmark papers, so notably in 2014, you outlined a technology where you can specifically target bacteria that have an antimicrobial resistant sequence. And you do this with CRISPR. Before we get into the details of the technology, can you just remind us why you would want to target bacteria in a sequence-specific manner? Why that's an added value?
Right. So you've got, of course, lots of antibiotic resistance building up at the moment in bacterial infections that are getting harder and harder to treat. You've got also lots of variant bacteria, but you have to remember that you also have all the good bacteria, right, that live in our microbiome and that are useful to us for many reasons. They protect us against disease, as they help us digest food, and they have a lot of benefits. And turns out that actually many of the bacteria that cause infection are what we call opportunistic pathogens, and they can actually have also positive roles. And sometimes you have within a given bacterial species, you have some strains of that species that can actually have beneficial effects, and others that can encode toxins or antibiotic resistance genes that could potentially make them dangerous at some point if you're immunocompromised or if you have other problems where they could cause an infection. And so it might be of interest to specifically eliminate so bacteria that carry the antibiotic resistance genes or the virulence genes to stop these infections or to make sure that if an infection ever happens, then at least we're able to treat it with antibiotic.
And so the way you did this is with a really innovative technology. So can you talk about what is your phage-made construct and how you essentially have made this system to deliver CRISPR into the bacterial cells?
Right. So I'm sure you've heard about this CRISPR-Cas systems, this DNA scissor is able to cut DNA precisely, and they're guided by this small RNA. So you just have to change the sequence of this guide RNA, and you can direct typically the Cas9 protein to to go and bind and then cut the target sequence. And so what we found out is that this cleavage in the chromosome of bacteria is actually lethal for the bacteria in most cases. So bacteria just don't know how to repair the type of breaks that is being made in this way. And so they just die. But in order to kill the bacteria, let's say in a patient, you need to be able to deliver this CRISPR-Cas system efficiently to all the bacteria in the target population. And that is actually the big challenge of the technology. So the CRISPR-Cas9 part is actually easy and works well in most respects, but you need to deliver it. And so when thinking about that, we turn to bacteriophages because they're naturally evolved to do this, to inject DNA into target bacteria. And they want to inject their DNA specifically in only some bacteria where they will be able to reproduce and not in just any bacteria that they meet. And so so what we did is that we engineered delivery vectors taking advantage of these phages, but instead of packaging the phages on genome, we just package a plasmid that carries a CRISPR-Cas system so that we can then deliver to the target bacteria.
Mm-hmm. And just maybe for the listeners, yeah, you've done a study where you have Staphylococcus aureus mixed population. Some are resistant to antibiotics, some are not. And then through this phage mid delivery, you manage to only target the ones and kill the ones that have that resistance sequence. And in your paper, you also demonstrate this in vivo. So it's in a mouse model of skin infection. You mentioned delivery as an issue for scaling up in vivo. Do you envision other main challenges that are kind of the quantum leap between the in vitro and the in vivo success?
Yeah, so I think there are two main aspects to this engineering. So as I say, the CRISPR part itself, once you have the Cas9 or whatever other Cas protein expressed inside the bacteria, that aspect is fairly robust. But you need to get there. So you need to be able to deliver the DNA, which, as I was just saying, is a big challenge. You also need to be able to express the DNA that is being delivered to produce the CRISPR-Cas systems. So on the delivery aspect, so as I was saying, we can harness bacteriophages, but the problem you encounter here is that bacteriophages tend to be very specific to the bacteria they infect, and typically they will only infect a few strains within a bacterial species. And this means that you need to identify the right phage capsids that target the bacteria you want to eliminate, or you eventually need to work with cocktails of capsids that can target the group of bacteria you want to target. This DNA in the bacteria, you need to have the DNA being expressed, and the DNA shouldn't be also degraded by all the defense system that can exist in bacteria. And you have to remember that bacteria naturally protect themselves against the bacteriophages and against all other genetic elements. And one of the main mechanisms they use for that is that they just degrade the DNA that comes in. And so they have evolved these mechanisms to specifically recognize foreign DNA and get rid of it. And so one of this mechanism is simply what we call restriction modification systems. Where basically the bacteria marks its DNA, typically with methylation marks on specific sequence patterns. And when the DNA comes in that doesn't carry this modification, it knows it's foreign, and then it can degrade it with nucleases. Another mechanism that bacteria use to protect themselves and degrade foreign DNA is actually CRISPR-Cas systems themselves. Actually, that's actually how they work. And you have also other possible mechanism that could defense mechanisms that could possibly block also the expression of foreign DNA being delivered into the bacteria, and we keep actually discovering novel defense systems every year. I know it's a very hot field right now and very interesting field as well. And so when we design these CRISPR-Cas antimicrobials, we also need to be mindful of all these defense systems that could lead either to the degradation of our payload or its lack of expression. And so there is also a lot of engineering effort that goes into having the right plasmid, the right vector for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of issues you mentioned here. So if you were, say, in a binary sense, when you're trying to target a bacterium, if it has an endogenous CRISPR, that's generally going to make it harder for your CRISPR construct to work?
So we don't think of CRISPR necessarily as the biggest hurdle. So the first reason is that the CRISPR will only possibly be a problem if it has already acquired a previous memory of our drug. So if it previously encountered it and learned and captured a piece of DNA that then it can use to produce guide RNA and destroy your vector, then yes, it could be a problem. Otherwise, it will need to first acquire that memory, and that happens at fairly low frequencies, and then eventually that could become a problem. So one possible way to bypass this type of defense would actually be to employ anti-CRISPR proteins. And so those are proteins that actually phages themselves have evolved to counter CRISPR-Cas systems. And so if we want to target a specific bacterial clade that we know has very active CRISPR-Cas immunity, that could possibly be a problem because it could develop resistance against our strategy, then we could already think about maybe also adding anti-CRISPR proteins to our payload.
Yeah, and these limitations we're talking about are bacterial immunity. But what about host immunity? So do you think, for example, just your little phage construct could be immunogenic to the host such that you couldn't give repeated administrations?
Yeah, so that's a valid concern. And that's actually a concern that people interested in just phage therapy also face. So basically, this strategy where we deliver CRISPR-Cas using phage capsids, it's analogous in many ways to phage therapies. And so people have noticed that if you inject phages intravenously, then eventually the patients will develop an immunity that could completely block the phages and make the treatment ineffective. And so that's one of the reasons that we, at the moment, we're not looking into indications of where we would need a systemic injection of our therapy. We're more thinking about it as a way to modulate the microbiome and eventually eliminate specific bacteria that carry antibiotic resistance, virulence genes from the microbiome. And in the microbiome, we think that this immunity is going to be a lot less of a concern, in particular because we already have billions of phages in our microbiome, and our immune system has learned to live with them and it doesn't necessarily inactivate them. And it's a different type of mucosal immunity that is happening there that we don't think is going to affect our strategy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so as you mentioned, there are some lytic phages that are licensed to kill bacteria, I think both in humans and animals, notably for Salmonella. And they do come against issues like releasing endotoxin like LPS when they kill the bacteria, also purity issues. Are all of those, because you use kind of a streamlined component, do you avoid these issues or do you also face them?
Yeah, so things like releasing endotoxin, et cetera, will also, just like this immunity question we just talked about, they're going to be a problem if you want to do a systemic treatment, if you want to treat bacteria that's in the blood. But if you want to just lyse bacteria that are in the gut, that's typically not going to be a problem to have bacteria lyse and possibly release LPS or other endotoxins. And you had a second part to your question, but I don't remember what that was.
Yeah, well, in entire phage preparations, there's often like manufacturing issues with purity, or at least historically there were, and that was
yeah.
Some of the the concerns?
Yeah, so definitely, I think what we do is much more streamlined in many ways, because indeed we control all aspects of our drug, right? We control the capsid. We can modify the capsid at will through genetic engineering, and we can modify the DNA payload at will. We know exactly what's on the DNA payload. There are no genes of a non-function. And so in many respects, this is a much more controlled drug than what a phage therapy would be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, you've answered my question, but the thinking behind it was that, for example, with the ChAdOx platforms that we have with the Oxford vaccine, notably, there's an issue if you repeatedly administer the same vector that you're going to be raising immunity to the vector. And then if there's subsequent, for example, gene therapies that are using the ChAdOx backbone, and a single individual won't be able to receive that. But then, as you said, if it's not systemic, supposedly we won't run against the same type of issues.
Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, we still need to evaluate that maybe more carefully, but in the gut, you expect to have some IgA immunity that is different from the IgG, IgM immunity you would raise in the body. And so, we don't expect necessarily to see inactivation of our vector even after repeated dosing. But again, I think that's still something that maybe we need to investigate a bit more.
Okay. And obviously, the really interesting questions that your work raises is in terms of evolution. So it's all well and good to eliminate bacteria at time T, but how do you make sure that over time, the populations that did not uptake your construct or somehow inactivated it don't come to dominate in the population? So in other words, how can we put selective pressure against the bacteria that are not sensitized by your CRISPR system?
Right, so that's definitely a very interesting point. So you have to bear in mind that none of the antimicrobial strategies we have typically eradicate the whole population, right? You always have some bacteria that survive one way or another, and typically even when you treat patients systemically, typically if you can reduce the bacterial load tenfold or hundredfold, that can be enough for the immune system to take over and do the rest of the job and help in the response. When we're talking here, like I was saying, our focus is more targeting bacteria in the microbiome. And when you do that, actually, we take advantage of the sequence specificity of our drug to only eliminate the bacteria we need to eliminate without touching the rest, and even without touching other bacteria of the same species that might not carry the virulence or antibiotic resistance gene. And then what that means is that when we eliminate our target bacteria, the rest of the bacteria we don't touch are still there, and they can grow and occupy the niche. And then this doesn't leave any room for the targeted bacteria to come back. So then even if we don't eliminate all the bacteria, even if we only reduce them a hundredfold, then if they don't have a niche anymore to grow, we still effectively reduce them, if not completely eliminate them.
All right, so you're like surfing on the bacterial competition wave in a way, and just...
Yeah, exactly. The idea is to take advantage of the competition that will exist in the microbiome to apply a specific selective pressure to remodel and modulate this population.
Okay. And in terms of how much of an advantage the surrounding wild-type strains have, can you maybe talk about whether your CRISPR construct has a fitness cost? So a fitness cost is when, for the listeners, when you have a certain mutation, let's say that confers resistance to antibiotic, that can actually be detrimental in the absence of an antibiotic. For example, if it reduces rates of protein translation or disrupts a metabolic pathway. So by just giving this CRISPR construct, are they somehow disadvantaged?
Right, so here it's I think this is a general problem whenever you start to express any foreign gene, any transgene in a bacteria, you can possibly have a fitness cost of expressing anything just because you're using metabolic resources from the bacteria that it could otherwise use for its growth or for something else. So that said, if you optimize your constructs well, you don't necessarily see a big cost of having a synthetic construct expressed in a bacteria. And typically, just expressing CRISPR system doesn't necessarily produces a cost. So that said, of course, if you deliver a lot and you produce a lot, then yes, even a bacteria that doesn't have a target in its genome might endure some fitness cost. So then the question is that a problem or not? So if we start to deliver our CRISPR, let's say, to strain of target species, but maybe that strain is harmless because it doesn't have the antibiotic resistance and we don't want to really kill it, then maybe we might reduce a bit its fitness. But that, in some sense, is a very limited effect on the microbiome in general, and a very limited risk that is happening here, because we have this first layer of specificity provided by the bacteriophage, right? We're only going to deliver to the system to only a very narrow set of bacteria in the first place.
And precisely the power of the technology is that you can choose any, theoretically, any sequence to target. So we've mentioned antibiotic resistance genes, virulence genes, but we could also think of toxin, antitoxin systems, of pili, of essentially anything. So could you kind of do a pitch of the perfect gene that you would want to target? What kind of properties would that gene have?
Right. So when we started this work, we were definitely going after antibiotic resistance gene, and I still think those are very interesting target, and we're still interested in targeting, for instance, carbamazepine resistance gene that are really a problem in many nosocomial infections, for instance. And being able to eliminate this type of antibiotic resistant bacteria in patients that are, for instance, going to undergo surgery can be very beneficial. You have populations of patients who will undergo, for instance, a transplant if they are colonized with antibiotic resistance, E. coli or Klebsiella. Maybe the doctor will decide actually not to do the surgery, because if you have this multi-drug resistant bacteria, you're almost sure that if an infection occurs during the procedure, you won't be able to then treat the patient, and the odds of having a bad outcome then can be very, very high. And at the moment, we don't have any good strategy to decolonize patients that carry these bugs before they would undergo such a procedure. So that's one case that we're interested in, for instance.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously, antibiotic resistance is the elephant in the room in terms of application. But then what would be great is when we have virulence genes that are very specifically only found in the virulence subset.
Yeah.
Then we
I can give you another example, which is actually some data that we released very recently with Eligo Bioscience. So that's a company I co-founded to now push this strategy of CRISPR antimicrobials. And so our first indication is for the treatment of Shiga toxin producing E. coli. And so those are a subset of Escherichia coli that express this very nasty toxin that can cause kidney failures, and it's especially dangerous to children and can even be lethal. And so E. coli itself is not a bad bug, right? It's a common cell of our gut. We all or almost everyone carries it, and it has its place in our microbiome and plays a beneficial role. But you clearly want to eliminate the ones that carry these toxin genes. And so we are developing a therapeutic strategy to deliver CRISPR-Cas system in these specific E. coli strains and kill them by targeting the toxin gene.
Yeah, toxin, that's toxins would definitely be a great target. But I've also heard about an approach which wasn't genetic, but what they called ultra narrow spectrum antibiotics. And it was also, so in uropathogenic E. coli, which have a specific adhesion tip that they use to colonize bladder and gut cells. And so what they did was, I think it was a soluble molecule that would prevent the blinding, like glycomimetics. But then obviously getting that magic bullet through the CRISPR would also be a way to eliminate that. I mean, there's hopefully a scoria of these specific virulence genes which we can slowly investigate.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are lots of interesting ideas out there right now that are being explored to be more specific. I think it comes from the general concern that antibiotics are not only selecting for more and more resistances and making it harder and harder to treat patients, but also they're sort of a weapon of mass destruction when it comes to treating someone, right? And they don't only kill the bacteria you want to eliminate, they keep many other bacteria in the gut, and that can possibly have some bad effects. So although for most people, it's only very transient and the microbiome goes back to normal, it's known that it's an important risk factor to develop imbalances in the microbiome, dysbiosis that can lead to other disease, or that can lead to, for instance, infection by Clostridium difficile, etc.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we can move on to speak more about the microbiome. So actually, I quite like the framework you have in one of your recent reviews. So you say that microbial engineering can be additive, subtractive, or modulatory. So we said additive is essentially, it's quite maybe the most commonly known, where you're supplementing the host with a live bacterial strain, like commonly lactobacillus. Subtractive is what we've mentioned, by selectively removing bacteria based on their sequence. But then what's maybe more interesting is that modulatory aspect you're speaking about. So your idea is to be essentially delivering or changing functions to specific bacteria. So maybe so we have a more precise idea. What kind of functions are you talking about?
Right. So basically, with Eligo Bioscience, over the last few years, we've spent a lot of efforts into engineering bacteriophage vectors and capsids to deliver DNA to different bacteria. And so then we started to wonder whether beyond just delivering a CRISPR-Cas system to kill these bacteria, we could possibly also deliver other things that could be helpful for the patients. And so possibly you can think about delivering a lot of different things, genes that would express, that would, I don't know, change the metabolism of the bacteria, that would express different compounds, could be immunomodulatory, you could think about cytokines, you could think about a lot of different things that could also have an effect on the host. So the idea would then be to basically turn your bacteria into some sort of drug factory that could help cure a specific disease. Either modulate the metabolism, the activity of the microbiome, or even have them express possible drugs.
I was thinking, even on a more trivial note, if you get them, I can degrade ethanol, you'd probably sell them as like a hangover cure for
right. There is actually a company doing that, not with phage delivery, but they engineered a Bacillus subtilis strain to degrade ethanol, and they're selling that as a pill against hangover or whatever. Not sure if it really works or not, but that's the idea is interesting at least.
Yeah, I mean, you can get creative, because even like with sports doping, anabolic steroids, if you get your bacteria to provide it for yourself, and I mean, you can imagine all kinds of things, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think then what would be legal or easy to do, etc., is a different question. But at least, the principle, it's an interesting concept. I think you also need to whatever you want to have your bacteria produce or do, I think you always need to also think about whether you could just simply do that by taking whatever supplement or drug orally, and what's the benefit of having the bacteria produce it versus having other routes of administrations.
Okay.
But, yeah.
So one of the focus you've taken with Eligu is the skin microbiome and acne. Can you maybe say why you chose that target, why that'd be a good model to start off with the technology?
So acne is clearly a big unsolved problem. And turns out that the bacteria causing acne, called Cutibacterium acnes, is actually a notoriously difficult bacteria to work with and to engineer. And so we've made some really exciting progress working with these bacteria at Eligo in the last few years. And so we're excited to see where we can take that now, but I cannot give much more details right now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure with all these microbiome issues, the issues aren't just technological, but they're also in the actual hypothesis, because I wonder how many disease states are actually tractable based on how much we know about which bacteria causes what. And maybe acne is actually only one of those rare examples where there's such a good causal relation with bacteria.
Yeah, it's not even for acne. I mean, it's not so clear in some sense. I mean, we know there is overgrowth of this bacterium, but everyone does carry acne. I mean, it's one of the most important common cells on the skin, and it doesn't have this inflammation and overgrowth in any people. So there are important interactions with a host, we know it's only happened in certain periods of life. There might be interactions even with other bacteria on the skin or the phenomenon, and in the end it's still fairly poorly understood. So there is still lots of work to be done in deciphering basically the etiology of acne.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested, if you can speak about it really quickly, about patents, because I would recommend it too. So I've read The Code Breaker, which is a book about the CRISPR discovery, and it kind of presents the picture of the patent war that has ensued with CRISPR and all of the controversies. So for example, the technology you're talking about, is this like a one gene, one bacteria thing, where let's say you find an enzyme and you do it in E. coli, that's one patent, and then you want to move it to staph, that'd be a different one? Or do you kind of have proprietary rights over the concept of delivering genetic payloads to bacteria of the microbiome?
Right, so patents are always a very complex matter, and it's also can be tricky to comment also on patent matter, because there are always some legal implications, etc. But I think, I mean, in general, patents can be either very broad or they can be very narrow. And typically, if you're seeking a very narrow patent, it's easier to get than if you're seeking a very, very broad patent. And when you want to develop a technology, of course, you need to make sure that you have what we call the freedom to operate, right? That you have all the right licenses that you need to be able to put your product on the market, and to do the work that you're doing. And so that might involve some broad IP, that might involve some more specific IP. And usually you end up with a combination of many different things. So in the case of CRISPR, we all know about the big IP fight that was happening between, in particular, Berkeley and the broad MIT, Harvard, where they basically the work of Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier on one side, and on the other side the work of Feng Zhang. I actually haven't followed the latest development there, but basically the dispute mostly revolved around genome editing in human cells. What we're doing is different, so we are not really affected by this specific IP battle. But of course, we still need to have the right patents to be able to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I probably anticipate that CRISPR is going to continue to be a minefield in terms of patents. So we'll see about that. to move maybe to some of your more recent research interests, you've been using CRISPR as a tool to do genome-wide screening of bacterial populations. So what you do is use libraries of single guide RNAs to basically cover the whole genome and mutate genes one by one. Why do you do this? What kind of questions are you trying to answer with this technology?
Right. So far we talked mostly about these CRISPR antimicrobial things that basically I initiated during my postdoc at the Rockefeller University, and that we're now continuing, and that mostly Eligo Bioscience is actually pursuing right now. And I have two hats, right? So my Eligo Bioscience hat, but I'm also the head of the synthetic biology group at Pasteur, and so we decided on the Pasteur side to focus our efforts lately on better understanding CRISPR-Cas tools, better describing them and improving them for bacterial genetic applications. And so one of the efforts, we put a lot of efforts recently in developing high throughput screens in bacteria using CRISPR-Cas9. And so those simply rely on the fact that Cas9 being super easy to reprogram, you just need to change the guide of the sequence of a small guide RNA. You can possibly construct libraries of hundreds of thousands of guide RNAs that will guide Cas9 to basically almost any position in the chromosome of the bacteria. And so there are many things you can do with Cas9. So the 1.0 CRISPR-Cas9 technology was just basically genome editing, and that worked really well, especially in human cells, where you just cut the target gene and you have a DNA repair that comes in and typically makes small insertions or deletion of the target sequence, and that's useful if you want to inactivate the gene. So as I was saying before, when you cut with Cas9 the chromosome of bacteria, actually you kill the bacteria, so you don't actually do this modification. So for that reason, we've been mostly focusing on the dead Cas9 variant. So that's a catalytic mutant of Cas9 that instead of cutting the target DNA, just goes and bind to the DNA. And what that does is that it can block the expression of target genes very efficiently. And so then we can turn that into screens also quite easily and start to probe a lot of different processes. So the first thing we did was just simply to construct libraries that will target all the genes in the chromosome of E. coli and then see what happens if you block them one by one. And you grow the bacterium in just laboratory conditions, you would expect that blocking the expression of genes that are essential to the bacteria, then these guide RNAs will be depleted, right? So bacteria carrying them would just not grow, and then we can measure that. And so we first observed all these, recapitulated, basically able to rediscover all the essential genes of the bacteria. And once we established that, then we can start to answer more questions. And so one of the things we did lately was to actually address this question of gene essentiality, not just at the level of a single bacterial strain, but at the level of the whole species. And so it turns out that the concept of gene essentiality is a very important concept in genetics, because it's a set of genes that basically really the bacteria cannot live without. And so they encode all the important functions in the bacteria. And it's also very interesting to consider how this essentiality evolves, how a gene becomes essential, or may a gene lose essentiality. And turns out that we have very few insights into this these processes, And mostly the reason for that is doing a screen that enables you to characterize all the essential genes is actually a fairly work-intensive process. And as a result, people have done that typically only on a few model bacterial strains. But because actually CRISPR-Cas9 is so easy to implement and work with, we're able to take that to the next level and perform this type of screens, not just on one model strain of, so typically working with the Escherichia coli bacterium, but now we've been able to carry these screens of gene essentiality on a set of 18 E. coli strains that are representative of the genetic diversity of this bacterial species. And so with this, we were able to obtain a lot of insights into the basically whether the essential genes are conserved through the species or whether they can change. And actually, we did see a lot of genes that can change their essentiality status even within the same bacterial species and growing all the strains in the same condition, et cetera. We see quite a lot of differences that are very interesting to investigate.
Okay, so the genes that we define as being necessary for viability have maybe been like skewed by our model systems.
Absolutely. I think, typically for Escherichia coli, we mostly know about one specific model strain called K12, and we don't know actually so much about all the other bacteria of this species that is an incredibly diverse species. And so we're able to see that actually the gene flow that happens within the species actually can modify the essentiality of many genes in the in the bacteria, and that's an interesting phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that the way you're doing it is in a way not hypothesis driven. It's kind of like the good old days of random mutagenesis with UV or whatever the mutagens are.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big believer in technology-driven research. I don't know. There was a famous quote from someone. I don't remember it exactly, but saying something along the lines that the big discoveries they come first from new technology and only then from a new hypothesis, right? So I think whenever you have a new microscope, so to speak, you will see new things, right? And that's, I think, in a sense, the fastest route to making new discoveries.
Mm-hmm. And it's positive. I mean, I'm thinking if one of our professors here would mention that some people sometimes they go for routine screening and then they become vomits, which is victim of medical imaging technology, where you pick up something that, you know, oh, you suddenly have a cancer or something. But I guess here it's in the positive sense, so.
So, I mean, it's, I think there is still, in a big part of research communities, some sort of prejudice against these more technology-driven approaches. I think people are still very attached to more hypothesis-driven research. And the fact that you need to have an hypothesis before you go to the bench and you do your experiments, and I think that is a valid approach, and you can of course learn many things from that, and a lot of what we know comes from this approach. But I think there is also a lot of value in more technology driven approaches and developing new technologies to enable to look at new things and make new discoveries. I think that's a very powerful thing that is really driving, especially modern science.
Okay, and yeah, so one of the tools you may be more invested than the Cas9, which is kind of littered all over the media, has been Cas12. I mean, there's a whole zoo of Cas enzymes, but what is maybe more interesting about Cas12 that you want to exploit?
Yeah, so it's true that like 99% of the applications of CRISPR-Cas systems have used this CRISPR-Cas9 system. And you have to remember that actually there is a huge diversity of CRISPR-Cas systems. So we divide them in mostly two classes, and I think now we're probably over 20 types and subtypes of CRISPR system. And the CRISPR-Cas9 one, and the one that specifically is used in technological application, is just class 2, type 2, subtype A. And you have this whole zoo of CRISPR-Cas system, and we're finding more and more useful things also when studying these systems. And actually, so now we're starting to see a lot more of them being applied for technological purposes. And one of those is this CRISPR-Cas12, so type 5 systems. And Cas12, in a sense, works in a way that's very similar to Cas9. It's also just a single protein effector guided by a small RNA that will go and introduce a double strand break at the target sequence. So the exact way it does that is slightly different. It's not the exact same type of double strand break, but in a sense, for many applications, Cas9 and Cas12 are just interchangeable.
Okay. I mean, there's probably a lot to say about the CRISPR field in general. Maybe we can finish off by you telling us what's your most anticipated research development in the CRISPR field. What are you most eager about in that research area?
Right. So I think it's very exciting to see right now how a lot of these CRISPR-Cas tools are actually getting into the clinic. And we've seen just over the last few months, very exciting announcements about clinical trials and positive results for patients in CRISPR gene therapy for a few disease. So we've seen a case for treatment of beta thalassemia. There are these two blood diseases that people are looking into, and there was also a recent announcement from this company Intellia, where they were able to help patients by actually doing some in vivo editing, treating the cells of the patients directly in vivo, which is a very interesting and very big advance, I think. So yeah, I think those are definitely interesting developments, and I think we're seeing also new CRISPR-Cas tools coming out on a very regular basis. And I think probably over the last 5 or 6 years, every year I'm thinking, okay, that's about it. We've reached peak CRISPR, right? It won't go any further. But then almost every year we have a new hot thing that comes out, and that's super exciting. And in terms of kind of basic discoveries around CRISPR, I think one of those very exciting thing was the discovery of CRISPR-Cas transposons. So those are transposons that have co-opted CRISPR-Cas system not to fight presumably against bacteriophages or foreign DNA, but to guide their transposition to specific loci in the chromosome of bacteria. And those have also very interesting technological applications that are being pursued by different groups. Mm-hmm. And then there's lots of cool things happening on the engineering of different improved variants of our new genome editing strategies. So one is called base editing, another is called prime editing, and we're seeing new variants, ever more powerful, or that can do new things of these systems that are very promising as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot, and it's the CRISPR strikes me as, because physicists always speak about like thinking from first principles research, but I've come across the concept of like zero order principles, which are before they exist, you can even imagine what would become of the discovery. And I think genome editing really is like that, but we just couldn't anticipate the incredible developments that would have occurred. It was just like unfathomable before. So there's probably a lot with CRISPR that's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the field still has a lot to offer, and hopefully it will benefit society in the end with more treatments available for people, but also I think it's a field that's going to have a very high impact, not just in medicine, but also in other fields and in the engineering of I don't know, bacteria for the fermentation of different interesting molecules, or even in agriculture. I think we're going to see a very big impact of CRISPR-Cas.
Yeah, the future is biotech, for sure.
Yeah.
If people want to find out about your research, I mean, you have a lab website. Is that where you would redirect them to?
Yes, sure. Yeah, check out our website or our publications. If you want to figure out about the science we're doing at the Pasteur Institute, you can, of course, also go to the Aligo Bioscience website to learn more about our company. I think it's just aligo.bio.
Okay, well, thank you for your time. Yeah, I mean, your research is really exciting, so really looking forward.
Yeah, thank you so much for the interview.